Happy Australia Day, everyone. I hope you all had a good day. Obviously, it's a public holiday, so we don't have the normal amount of showings here. So there is a fair amount of people online, but not the huge amount that normally is on. So today being Australia Day, I'll probably make it a relatively quick one. We have five or six questions come in over the last couple of weeks, over the last month. And today on Australia Day represents 18 years of marriage to my beautiful wife. I made sure that I got married on Australia Day simply for the fact that I couldn't forget my anniversary. So I really should probably get back to the family, and I'll go through these pretty quickly. So as most Q&As, I always start with telling you that I'm a plumber and builder by trade, and anything I say here is my opinion on my understanding and learnings. Anything that I do say here, you need to go off and get qualified advice from the professionals that are qualified to give it to you. You shouldn't make financial decisions on what I've told you. This is for general information. Make sure you get good advice. That's my disclaimer. So on with the show, as we say. First question's come in here. I've just gone through the 25% Club DVDs that were sent out. I still can't get my head around the finance on these bigger deals. Say the land is purchased in a trust and the intention is to build six-story unit block, say 18 units. That's obviously commercial lending and the trust borrows the money, but who is behind it? Well, it's the guarantor that will be behind it. Is it the developer? Well, as soon as you set up a trust and you're going to build 18 units, you automatically become the developer. So that being said, yes, you are the developer. Yes, you are guaranteeing the loan. How is your developer assessed in the case? Like any other loan is assessed. So it's probably in commercial circumstances a bit harder because as a developer, they want to know that you've got a track record and that you've got experience. So, and I've been through this process where, you know, you go to work for a commercial loan and they say to you, well, what experience do you have in that business? And if you've got none, it's a tough game, right? So, you know, that's why I always, I don't know, I'm probably sure most of you have heard me say, start with something small, do a duplex or a triplex and then build from that. So anyway, let's get on with this one. Is it the developer that takes the risk personally if all goes south, or what happens if something goes wrong? Absolutely. There's not many loans that they will give out that don't have someone's name behind it. So, you know, and let's take developer out of here and let's say the person that controls the trust or the guarantor of the trust. I understand that they will ask for pre-sales and that will be a determining factor, but doesn't someone still have to be behind the loan? Absolutely, the controller of the trust. The development isn't a person, so no, that's right. So the person who controls the trust will have to be the guarantor. If it falls under residential lending, say a triplex, it is then me as a private person. It's no different. Whether you do a single house, a duplex, a triplex, or 100,000 or 100 units, there's still someone in the background that has to be a guarantor. And that's why developers go broke all the time, because they have to put themselves up for it. And so, yes, at every point in time when they're looking at loans, they'll be looking at your financials and that you can service the loan, and that they, you know, especially with bigger commercial loans, they'll be factoring in delays and all the costs that go with the delays, interest rates, all that sort of stuff, people pulling out of pre-sales, all that sort of stuff. So essentially, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, where you are in Australia, you're going to have to be a guarantor. The fact is a fact. It is what it is. Asset protection is one thing in a trust, but when it comes to the guarantor component, someone always has to put up their name, and it's usually the beneficiaries or the appointers in the trust or the directors of the company that will have to put up. Hi, Dimney, and we've done our due diligence on a renovate, build, subdivide in suburban Melbourne and would like some advice. Wilson, someone, can you just tell me that you can hear me? I only want Wilson to tell me. I don't want 1,000 people because there's someone saying they can't hear me. So, or Malcolm would be good as well. If you could just tell me that you can hear me. Yep, thank you. So, Christine, it's your issue on your end. I am talking. Okay, the property is 1,059, has an existing three bedroom, two bathroom house on it. We're looking to renovate the house, and so 9% of 500. So using a rule of thumb there, okay? So 9% is the rule of thumb when you're looking at doing a cosmetic renovation. Now remember, don't go off 9% and just say that that's your FISO. Do a detailed FISO around the renovation, not just allow 5%, 9%. That's just a rule of thumb so that you've got to gauge and understand. I want to build two new three bedroom, two bathrooms on the back of the block and subdivide strata, common driveway, then sell down two and keep one for rental. So before I go any further on in this question, I automatically will pull to the fact that we're in Melbourne, right? And in Victoria, when you say subdivision, for the rest of the country, it means something else. Okay, so for the rest of the country, when you mention the word subdivision, we're talking about chopping off a piece of land and having two titles that are completely separate. There's no body corporate, there's no annual general meeting, there's nothing, right? It's two completely different titles. In Victoria, though, when they talk about chopping land in half or doing strata title, it's all commonly known as a subdivide. So I'm just putting it out there at the moment that if you're in Victoria, it means completely different thing to the rest of the country. And when you ring someone, Victoria rings someone, a planner from outside, the planner doesn't understand your terminology and the reverse happens coming in. So going back to the question. Costings for purchase reno builds is 1 million and expected in values of 400k to 450 each, giving a profit buffer of about 200. Our question is regarding which is the best one to keep, the original house or one of the new builds. Okay, well, most people can answer that straight away. There's not going to be, so it says it here in the question. The question's answering itself. Selling the new builds will trigger GST as well as capital gains, but will give better depreciation. Selling the old house would avoid GST. That's right, but being at the front of the block probably has a bit more land, etc., and lower depreciation amounts. I don't think, it is what it is. You've got a house at the front of the block, big whoop-de-doo. It is probably worth a little bit more, but it's an older house. Yes, you don't have depreciation. Remember that you'll have to pay depreciation back at some point in the future if you do have to sell. Well, you don't have to pay it back. It has to be factored in, right? Into your sale costs. So GST, yes, you will have GST for the first 5 years from on the new builds, from the point that they're available to be rented, okay, or when they're advertised to be rented. Now, so automatically, yes, the front house would be the smarter one to sell because it won't have GST if you're not in the business of real estate, okay? So that is, you're just an investor. If you're in the business of real estate, it will trigger GST straight away because that's your form of income, in which case it will be smacked with GST. For the rear buildings, the GST, yes, will be part of it. Now, remember also that the GST component has credits and debits. So whilst you say that maybe the back ones are worth 450, and there's development costs of $1 million, when you work out the GST component, you're not going to be that far out of pocket because during the construction of the driveway, so you've got $1 million. Essentially, you've got roughly 90, just under $90,000 worth of GST that you've paid the builder, you've paid the concreter, you've paid all these other people in the whole development. So if you were to sell the rear blocks for $900,000, technically, you'd actually end up with money in your pocket. And I'm not sure if that makes sense to you, but in essence, we've got a $900,000 sell of the back two, which is 450 times two, but it's cost you $1 million, and it depends how much you spend on the front block as well. But to me, the GST wouldn't be that much difference. Capital gains, you're going to pay. So the next part of the question is also depending on build time, is there an advantage in staggering the sales so they end up in different financial years? Sell one in June and one in July. We're buying in a company trust structure, and I assume 50% capital gains discount will flow. So you will get 50% if you've owned the property for 1 year and 1 day. If you're not in the business of real estate, you will get capital gains exemption. So in saying that, sell one in June and one in July? Well, maybe. The other thing, the beauty with a trust structure is that you can set up a bucket company anyway, and you can do the distribution to the bucket company if you don't want to pay, you know, if it lifts you into the next tax bracket or you don't want to go to the next tax bracket. It's a bit funny now, when it was quite clear cut previously with taxation laws, because taxation, you know, kicked in at $18,000 at 46 cents in the dollar kicked in. Since the change a couple of years ago, you're now paying 37 cents in the dollar up to $180,000 income. So, you know, you could go and pay company tax at 30 cents in the dollar, or pay 37 cents in the dollar and pay it to yourself. So it's a bit of a toss-up of what you do, knowing that you can put it into a bucket company, pay 30 cents in the dollar, and that's tax-paid money sitting there in the bucket company that could lend it to the next venture. Remembering that in any capital gain, in any event, Dintner's always about paying off bad debt and making sure you have good debt. So if there was a capital gains made on this, then for me personally, at this point in my life, I'm going, well, any money that I can get out as a profit somewhere, I'll pay the tax on it and I'll pay down my personal debt so that my personal debt is null and void, right? So that the house that I live in is completely paid off. I might have a mortgage again it, but that's good debt. That's because I'm lending out to other structures. So that's also a consideration that you need to have. So I know you'll probably say that it all depends on the deal, but I was just hoping you could go through the pros and cons of each generalized scenario, assuming all things are equal. So I've gone through a fair bit there. So let's just recap quickly. You have to look at your GST credits versus your debits. What's it going to end up with in the grand scheme of thing? Knowing that the front house hasn't got GST on it if you're not in the business of property, you might say to yourself, oh, well, you know, there's going to be minimal amounts spent on the front house. We've already said 9%, so 40 grand. So you won't really be able to claim the GST on that 40 grand. To me, from those numbers, roughly the spend that you've got, I reckon you'd end up neutral in GST, so it wouldn't matter that much. So the capital gains issue, well, capital gains is a capital gain. If you made a capital gain, you've made money, you've got to pay tax. For me personally, like I said in my scenario, I would be simply paying the tax and paying down my personal debt, then redrawing and going to the next deal. So turning it from bad debt into good debt. For some people, that they might say, well, you know, I don't want to pay 37 cents in the dollar, or I'm tipped into the next tax bracket. So in that case, I'll set up a bucket company and I will distribute the funds to the bucket company before the end of the financial year. Hi, how do you fire protect a home when strata titling it? Well, so if you're strata titling, or if you're splitting up something or building units or villas or townhouses where they have to be separated, there's a couple of ways you can do it. You can build the buildings 3 meters apart, in which case there's no need for fire rating, because as soon as you're 3 meters away, there's no need. Now, the other way is if they're interconnecting. So if the units that are connecting in any way, you need a FRL, a fire retardant, fire resistance level, it's FRL. And in most 1B buildings, so 1A buildings that are units, you need a 60-60-60 FRL. Now, the 60-60-60 comes down to structural adequacy, structural integrity, and fire and insulation. So essentially, the 60-60-60 means that if a fire was to happen in one compartment, they call it, when they fire rate, they call it compartmentization. So that's where you make separate compartments that if a fire starts in one compartment, it can't go to the next. So instead of calling them compartments, let's call them units, right? So we've got a 60-60-60 between each unit. So if a fire starts in one unit, it takes 60 minutes for either the place to structurally collapse, the integrity of the wall to start buckling and allow the fire through, or the fire insulation, where if the fire starts, the heat on the other side is not enough to start a fire. The way that they test is they put they get some sample materials around, and then they put little little receptors. Oh, I'm stuck for the word at the moment, probes on the back end of the wall, and they start a fire on the other side. So then they measure. And, you know, there's also another. So you've got different makeups. Now, when it comes to the fire rating, you have standard off-the-shelf BCA code-compliant materials. So if I'm building brand new, I can go in there and I know that if I put two layers of 16 mil fire check, no, not thermocouple. It might be a thermocouple, but it's something that measures heat, Malcolm. So I can go in and I can put two 16 mil layers of fire check gyprock, and I know that I'll get my 60, 60, 60, right? And as long as it's installed correctly and my fire engineer signs off on it, right? In other circumstances, like a block of units that we own, we needed to get fire resistance through them. The outside walls were brick, but the between the floors were timber, and the council wanted to make sure that we did have the 60-minute fire rating, in which case what you can then do is you can get a fire engineer to design something that meets the code, and it's signed off, and it's called acceptable solution. It's called in the BCA, it's called an acceptable solution, where an engineer will design it. What I did in this circumstance was I didn't want to put extra layers of gyprock on the roof because I didn't think that the structural integrity could handle it. So we rang a company that does something called intumescent paint. Intumescent, I-N-T-U-M-S-C-E-N-T. And what it is, it's a fire resistant paint. I didn't want to move all the tenants out. So what we did is we moved a couple of them had holidays booked in. So we said, when's your holidays? There was another one which I sent on a holiday. And we moved the furniture into the middle of the room. We masking taped everything up, and they sprayed the ceilings for us so that we could get our 60-60-60. So the ceilings are now stamped, and every year we get someone go in to do a visual inspection to make sure they're still intact and they haven't been broken or cracking or anything like that. So there's a couple of different ways you can do it. There's also a fire engineer could come in and say, all right, so I see that you need fire rating, but because there's a door there on one side of the building and a door on the other side of the building, if we link, put the smoke detectors in and link them, then it gives someone the right amount of time to get out. And I'll sign off on that. Now, you know, most engineers won't, but some will. So with most, well, modern day, as soon as you need fire rating between units, they will link smoke detectors. So if a smoke detector goes off in one unit or one compartment, it will then set off all the smoke detectors so the whole place is warned. If you had to retrofit those, they used to be really expensive because you had to run wires from unit to unit, but there's now a couple of companies that do it via RF frequency. So you set one up and all the rest of them are wired into lighting circuits, and simply by radio they transmit to each other. Question here was, must the fire rating be tested by a building certifier, or a builder can do that? No, it has to be a certified fire building engineer that has to sign off on them. Some building certifiers can do it. Most building certifiers will have someone that they can direct you to do that. Okay, we're looking at purchasing a villa in a block of three, and it's advertised as community title rather than strata with relatively low levies. Could you please explain the difference between community title and strata title, and are there any downfalls of one over the other? If it is possible in the future to buy the other two units, is it possible to convert them from community title to strata title? Not a big issue. When it comes to community and strata title, they are very similar. Generally, strata title is used for townhouses and villas and a lot of unit blocks. Community title used to be used for vertical apartments. It seems that depending on what state you are, it changes depending on what they want. So let's break it down very simply. Strata titling has a drawing where you have definite areas on your title, common areas, and so that you know exactly what you've got. In a community title, it's not that tight because you have an area drawn as part of your title, except you don't have any vertical arrangement to it. So that's where they usually come in units. With banks, I wouldn't even bother converting it from a strata title to a from a community title or strata title, because it makes no difference to the banks. The banks are happy, they're fine with it. You mentioned that there's low levies. It's probably low levies simply because it's a block of three, probably well built, and they've got enough money in the bank account not to have to worry about charging really huge amounts, whether it be a strata or a community title. It's just probably the building that's got the low levies on it. With both of them, they both have people that need to sit on there for their annual general meeting, all the rest of it goes with that. So one thing I will say, though, community and strata title are very similar. In Queensland, for example, if you set up a new one, you've got a strata title, but it's called a community management scheme. If you've got a duplex in most states now, you actually don't have to have – you can have strata title, but you don't have to have a body corporate because you've both got access to the front road and you don't need an annual general meeting for a dividing wall. Sorry about that. I've got a phone going off in the background. So hopefully someone will pick it up. I'll just wait for that. Sorry about this, guys. There is one thing that I will make you I'll alert you to, and there is something called a company title. And company title was how they used to do most units previous to 1964, I think it was. And company title doesn't give you a drawing of what you own. You are actually buying the title is owned by a company, and you are buying a share in the company. So you've got to be very, very careful when it comes to company title, because there's only a couple of lenders that will lend to it. Westpac and St. George are the two major lenders that go for company title, and it devalue, and your properties are devalued. So if you want to buy a cheap unit because you can't get in the market, look for company title. In Sydney, a lot of Darlinghurst and King's Cross have got company title, and you can buy them relatively cheap. That's what it's like. Ralph, do you still need to set up the body corporate bank accounts? Well, the body corporate will have a what do you call those people? God, I'm having a great day. They will have a body corporate president and secretary and all of that sort of stuff. And yes, the body corporate will have to have its own bank account. Obviously, no one liked that phone before. Chairman, thank you. The body corporate will still need to have a bank account. There's heaps of body corporate management companies across Australia which will do the whole corp. They'll do the annual general meeting. They'll make sure that everything gets paid, and they'll manage everything on behalf of the body corp for a percentage. Question here, if we were to purchase a house or unit that contained asbestos, are you a new owner required to remove it from the building? Not yet, Jen. There is talk about legislation coming in that you will need to remove asbestos at some point. There'll be an asbestos register, but geez, I don't think they can do that very soon. I'd say it'd have to be 20 years from now, 10 to 20 years from now, because you can't be expected to buy. Essentially, you're going to devalue everyone's property so much because of this asbestos. You don't have to remove it. What you do need to know, though, is if you're going to renovate it and you have to disturb it, you're best to remove it. It is fully tax deductible. The removal of asbestos replacement is fully tax deductible as part of it. Ralph, again, for three units, it wouldn't be worth to get it managed. No, I wouldn't. And especially if you own the whole three, all three of them, I wouldn't bother. Sometimes it's just a pain in the ass, and people will do it relatively cheap, but for three units, it's not worth their while. Okay. Hi, Ian. I have a 720 square meter block in Sunnybank Hills, Brisbane. I had plans to build a duplex or subdivide the lot. Had a quick read on the council website, and it seems like because the property is zoned as low development rancher, low density residential, A duplex is not considered and it cannot be subdivided. And minimum land area to build a duloc is apparently 2,000. I found another property in the same suburbs owned LDR and sitting on 354. How did the owner manage to subdivide and build on 354 square metres like? Should I apply for a material change of use to build a duplex? What is the process to apply for a material change of use? All right, so we're talking Queensland here. Material change of use is simply changing the usage from a single house into multiple housing or a subdivision. And a subdivision is actually not a material change of use. It's called a reconfiguration of a lot in Queensland. All right, let's start from the beginning. Second paragraph there is I had a quick read on the council's website. So, Kay, I'd like to say to you that if you're not a town planner, why are you reading it? Maybe because you're bored, that's fair enough, but you're not the one to read it. You shouldn't be reading it if you are trying to make a decision here, right? You should be getting a private town planner to do the work for you and giving you feedback on what you can and can't do on there. So let's say here, you said you found another property on 354 square metres. How did the owner manage to subdivide? Well, the owner didn't subdivide. The town planner got the approval for the owner to subdivide it. So the first thing I would be doing is going back to council records and finding who put that application in. Because if it is doable, the person that did that application, the private town planner or the surveyor that did that application or the or whoever did it, is the person you want to speak to. So quite simply, you should be looking for the private town planner that got that one down the road approved. Maybe it's something that's, you know, 20 or 30 years old, in which case it snuck through a while back and, you know, rules are rules and you can't change that. But I would seriously be trying to find some details around that. Applying for a material change of use, what is the process? Well, process is quite simple for me. If I know the council and it's not too hard, I'm at the point now where I can apply for my own material change of use because I've used people so many times before that I know all the questions to ask, I know what I have to fill out, and I know what I have to do. So in my first ones, if it is a council that's very difficult or it's a tricky application and I'm trying to push the edge, I will never do it myself. So I will get a private town planner to put a whole report together for me. I will get my designer to work with the town planner to get it to a point where they both understand what I want and we're not pushing it too hard. And then the material change just goes into council. The council looks at it. If it's code assessed in Queen, we're talking Queensland here. So if it's code accessible, the council planners will look at it. They'll say, okay, it's all okay, no problem, I'll tick the box. If it's impact assessable, which is probably what this one will be, because, you know, you're telling me that, you know, 2,000 square metres and this guy's got 354. So impact assessable means it's going to have an impact and it's outside what the planning allows you to do, so no longer is it code accessible. It will mean that it'll be a different process. It will have to be advertised in the papers and all over the place. And if anyone has a complaint, it'll have to go to a council meeting. And the councillors will have to vote with the recommendations of the planners inside the council. The planners inside the council will say to the councillors, we do recommend to it, get it approved or we don't. And then the councillors will make their decisions from that. So a question here. I'll get to the questions at the end. Let me answer these ones first. Hi, I'm a Sydney-based investor and looking to purchase around Brisbane, Ipswich. A likely strategy will be to buy a house, renovate and add a granny flat. This will be my first time investing from a distance, so I have a few questions. I will fly up to see the property once I've secured a deal and going through the due diligence. I'm wondering, however, how would I manage a renovation from a distance? Just get a builder to do it. How necessary is it to present to witness progress and keep an eye on things? Well, you know, I would expect that you would have to fly up there two or three times in the space of however long that renovation is going to take. Is it better to hire a project manager, even if it's only, well, if it's a 5 to 10K renovation, a carpenter may be able to help you out. But in most states, and especially Queensland, you're not allowed to project manage yourself. You'd have to get a builder on board anyway. Are there companies that do it? Absolutely, as a trade package, yeah. Just a builder would be able to do that. If I add a granny flat for, say, 90K, how likely is it they'll get an extra 90K for it on the reval? Look, the problem with granny flats is the great things with granny flats is the cash flow, right? The problem with granny flats is that when someone goes and builds a granny flat on the backyard, the cash flow is so good that they never sell them. So when it comes to a revaluation, there is nothing to compare it against. So a valuer will go in and they'll see a 3-bedroom house on the front and a 2-bedroom granny flat on the back, and they'll go, "Well, that's a 5-bedroom house. What's other 5-bedroom houses sold for?" And that's what our value is. That's because no houses with granny flats have sold. I can tell you that houses with granny flats sell for more, like in that scenario, for sell for more than what a 5-bedroom house would. So as soon as we've got a few more stock on the market that's gone over and turned over, then you're going to be at the point where, okay, all right, I can now say that my house is worth this much. I would be saying that out of a $100,000 granny flat, you're going to get 80 grand back. So you're hurting 20 grand or 20%. Will adding a granny flat reduce the potential rent on the main house? I don't believe so at all. I think it doesn't change it much at all because you've got separate entrances, separate yards. It might a tiny bit, but we're talking 5% if at most. So as long as you've got separate metering and separate everything, it's not really a big deal. Would having a granny flat reduce any future capital growth potential? Absolutely not. I mean, whatever the area grows in is what the growth potential will happen. Plus, you've also got the added fact that you've got a versatile block of land now. You've got something that's flexible where a big family could rent both the house and the granny flat. You can rent it separately. It's if you're selling it, a young couple could buy it and live the granny flat and rent out the house, or a young family could buy it and live in the house and rent out the granny flat. You're opening up the options huge when you put a granny flat in. What are your thoughts on doing granny flat as a kit home compared to built on site? It's much cheaper to do a kit home. What are the downsides? Some of the issues that you're going to have with a granny flat as a kit home, for example, in New South Wales, is that if you want to do a granny flat under the complying development with a private certifier, you can do a kit home. You can't do modular. It has to go through council. Kit homes are okay. It doesn't matter. They're doing some decent stuff. If you go back through the webinars and have a look at a webinar called Doing Business in China, there's a mate of Dibner's that's doing fold outs in this area. So I can't remember what webinar it is, but it's they're doing business in China. It was last year, mid last year. So have a look at that one. Hi Ian, two questions. We are currently gaining approval for a granny flat and studio to be added to block we own, which currently has one house on it. The granny flat, being in New South Wales, can be leased separately, but the studio is supposed to be used in conjunction with the house and not have a cooker. Yes. Strictly speaking, therefore, the only way to lease the studio is together with the house. Agree. I wouldn't be doing three leases because you would now be breaking the law and that would be stupid. I thought we could use a head lease though to get around this and lease the house and studio separately via subleases. Yes, you could do that. However, since the studio is not supposed to have a cooker, I'm not sure this head lease sublease may makes us compliant. Well, as soon as you put a cooker in there, you're in trouble. As long as there's, I'm going to say this quite clearly, right? I don't offer any opinion and advice around this on how to set it up. I do have an opinion on how you should set it up, though it's what I call a plastic rule. I don't believe it's being broken. I think I'm bending the rules to make it work. And it comes down to the 540 council areas you've got across the state, states across Australia. It also comes down to the Rental Tenancy Act in every state. And it also comes down to the Office of Fair Trading and how they see what you're doing. So, I do have a way I think that I believe works, but that's for me. And that's because I've done a hell of a lot of reading on the area. So I could take my same thing and take it to a different area and it won't work. So to be going on, to be compliant, maybe we can only rent the house and studio together and ask hire for rent. I believe you could probably do that. Encourage the tenants to sublease the studio and point them in the direction of a plug-in cooktop. Well, I don't know about pointing them in directions. That's up to them. Whatever they want to do, they can. I know it amounts to the same thing, but it's not us or doing the wrong thing. Yeah, and also you've got to make sure that whatever you're doing, you have in writing from the insurance company that they know what you're doing. Because if you don't have it in writing, it's not worth anything. Second part. I have a house in Southampton, England, which has been rented since I immigrated to Australia in 2005. I paid 185, it's worth 200 now. I never have trouble finding tenants and near the hospital, and it yields about 6%, which doesn't sound great, but no mortgage on it. So it's not, the yield is not a big deal. It's cash flow for you because you've got a low mortgage on it, so 50,000, and you're only paying 2.5% interest. So it's about 14 grand passive. So 14,000 Australia. So after tax, 10,000 Australian. Okay, so it's a 10,000 Australian passive income from a property overseas. I'm, however, contemplating selling it, as in the long term, my parents will be too old to help by doing inspections for me between tenants, and keep an eye on understanding how the property is going. Okay, fair enough. It's very hard to gauge this from just the agent, so it was always my long-term plan to sell. If I did sell after costs, I would walk away with about 200,000, 230,000 Australian at the current exchange rate, which I use to pay down my debt, so about 450. And an interest rate of 5% saves me about 11,000. With none of the hassle of an overseas property, the only thing is I think the property may be able to jump, may be about to jump in value. Done nothing for 10 years, and UK is looking pretty good. Okay. I would appreciate your thoughts. We have plenty of equity available here, 800,000, and okay income, so we can progress in property without selling. Though we do wish to do a townhouse development, so the extra money may be handy for a larger project. Okay. All right, so let's look at your scenario from what you've told me. You could sell that property, pay down debt. So that selling that property right now is giving you $10,000 after tax. You could sell the property in England, pay down your debt here, which would be saving you $11,000 in interest. So you're $1,000 ahead a year, right? You're not in a position where you have to sell it, right? So to me, like Dipner always says, real wealth comes from accumulation, not flipping, right? So for her, what she'd be saying is, well, you don't need to sell it. You've got $800,000 worth of equity here that you can go off and do other deals. And remembering what I said earlier, I'd rather you go and off and do a duplex or triplex rather than doing an eight townhouse development to start with, because there is so much you're going to learn in that. We cannot teach you experience. It's just not a possibility. So for me, I'd be doing something minor, and knowing that you've got a good income, $800,000 is a good start for a duplex, triplex style arrangement. Another question I would probably ask myself if I was you is, what if I went and got a loan at the maximum that I could over there and bring the money across here to do stuff? And how would that do stuff? So you're paying 2.5% interest over there, you're paying 5% here, right? So what if you went and got a loan against your property in England, brought it back to pay down your debt on your home? So now all of a sudden you're paying 2.5% less, and still getting a $10,000 income. I think you probably, if you did the figures on that one, you'd probably end up better off, because so 230, say 0450. So if you went, so you don't think you can borrow over there. Okay. I would put it on your parents' debt. Sorry, couldn't help me. Okay, so if you can't borrow over there, well, you can't do it. But to me, I also have the gut feel that because Europe has been stagnant for so long, that it will do a quick jump, and that it's looking better. I do say it is looking better. So it's probably something that I would be looking at. So to me, real wealth comes from accumulation. You're not needing to sell it. Yes, your parents are old, but that's such a minor thing in the grand scheme. You've got friends that could do stuff for you over there, and I know agents over there aren't that great either. But at the same token, if it becomes too much trouble, get on a plane for 4 or 5 weeks, do a little spruce up and put it on the market when it becomes a hassle. Up till then, I wouldn't be too fussed. I think I'd be keeping for me. But I do understand what you're talking about, wanting to pay down personal debt. I can understand that completely. So they're my views. I'm hoping that was helpful to you, Jennifer. Hi, Ian. Just bought a house and want to do some extensions and add a small kitchen at the new extension area so we can rent the house to two different tenants. Oh, I can see where this is going. However, we don't want to apply as a granny flat yet. Why not? I will only apply to the council for the extension work for now. The question I have, is it legal to rent to two different tenants when it's not a granny flat? Well, yes. If you can't rent it, if you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to. You break the law, then you're done. So why you wouldn't apply for a granny flat, I've got no idea. If you're willing, you know, there's no use setting up trust structures and asset protection if you're going to break the law, because there's no protection. Once you've broken the law and you've done something illegal, there's no use having asset protection because you're done. So property game is 100% compliance. If you cannot be compliant in property, don't do it. And compliance is a big thing that will run through people's lives. I've seen a student that pre-DIMNA went off and did all this illegal work, and in five different councils, and four of them in the space of 2 months cracked down on her, and she almost lost everything. If it wasn't, she worked with me personally. It was lucky that she had me to come to and ask different things, and we made things work, and she survived, and she's still going, thankfully. But, you know, you'll get caught out very quickly if you're not careful. So Jennifer with the English property says she may hold it. So, you know, just my thoughts, Jennifer. I just think it's a good thing to have those things sitting in the background ticking over, you know. Where else can you sit your money and double it in every, you know, England maybe every 15 years, you know, Australia every 10 years? You know, you might be able to buy a decent investment property over here as well, but the same token, I know that you're out here full time now and you've got residents here and everything. But, you know, there's also the flexibility of if you need to go back, then you can go back, you know. So that's my thoughts. I'm trying to get hold of the Victorian infrastructure map from the Department of Planning and Community Development website for Victoria, but not successful, okay. So what I did was, where are we down here? I went to Google, and I just Googled infrastructure projects Victoria. The major Victoria projects came up, wasn't too hard to find. And in here you go our projects, and it's got all the different projects around there that either have happened. Yeah, these are all the ones that have happened. So they're not useful to it. You can go by status to see where they are. I think more importantly, what's I think a great website is the National Infrastructure Construction website, and that's where it has a timeline for projects that are going on. You've got color coding here for the different states. So if we go to timeline, we can see here, if we move along, we can see lots of different infrastructure projects that are happening around the country. And the reason for having these is obviously because if you know that the Pacific Highway in Queensland from Warringeri to Majiraba is being extended, you might think, well, how long's that project? You can see it started in 2012 and is just finishing in this year. So not something that you'd want to go. So let's move our selector along to see what other projects are happening around the country. And then, okay, the NBN going in, right? Well, we saw that Geelong Hospital upgrade, which is pushing into 2016-2017. And, you know, you can click into these and it tells you about the project, how much money's being spent on it, where it is, who the major industry that's being affected by it. Yeah, I think it's a really fantastic website. So not too hard to find things when you're looking. And like I said, it's the first Google thing that I found, top two hits, and that was it. Okay, so I'll just answer a few questions. I might get off very soon so I can get back to my family. So don't send any more questions in. I will answer the ones that are here. New question. I'm currently looking at options to develop my block, knock down and build three townhouses or build two townhouses. I've met with a company that builds 600 a year and do everything from plans, approvals and constructions. I appreciate it'll probably pay extra to have this service from one company, but I'm wondering what the benefits are to separate the design and town planning approval process with the construction and finding a builder to build a design. It's in Victoria. I have a real issue with companies doing plans on your behalf, because they are then owned by that company and they'll put it through council, and then you'll get hit with the extra costs for the build, and you don't want to, you know, you're saying, well, that's too expensive. And they'll go, well, we own the plans. You say, well, can I buy it from you? And they go, no. So then you have to go through the whole planning process again, or you have to make a 25% change in the plans that are there. I don't like it at all. If they'll fix the prices for you and do all of that, which is going to be unlikely, then I'd go my life. Go for it. If you think you're happy and the fees are stacks up and all the rest of it. I'd much rather say to them, look, I'm interested in using you, but what's it going to cost me for to get the plans done? And I want in writing the fact that I own the plans and the copyright is mine, and that I can get any builder to build it. And if you're any good, if you build 600 a year and you're any good at pricing, you're going to build any other builder. You're going to beat any other builder that I bring to the table anyway. So do it that way. That's my feeling. I wouldn't do it any other way. Hi, Ian. There is an empty block a few streets away from my place. What is the easiest way to find out who is the owner and who they want to sell council? Look, because it's Victoria, it's terribly difficult to get stuff out of Victoria because of the privacy laws. I think sometimes some real estate agents have access to some information. Otherwise, I would be trying to talk. I'd knock on the owner's doors, on the neighbor's doors, and see whether they know anything about it. I would maybe talk to a real estate agent who would be interested in finding out the owner so that they can get a commission to sell to you, and working from that. So unfortunately, Victoria is very difficult to get information. It's probably the only state that's very hard. The rest of them are slightly okay. Another question here. I'm reading these ones. They're not on the screen. I'm trying to find a property which is big enough land to build a granny flat. It's quite hard. I have been offered to inspect 1,000 square meter land in another suburb 10 minutes away from where I was looking, which is a development site. It is wise for me to look into this further. Development site in suburb further away means to me that it may be harder to get tenants and interested in your suburb. Oh, you're a snob. I'm going to say that. How rude of me. But really, 10 minutes away, is it going to make a difference? I doubt it. And in the end, you know, if it's a development site, what are the numbers? You're going to have to get into the FISO. Frequently asked question number 3 on the Ultimate website will tell you what you can do. Talk to a private planner about what you can do. I don't know what state it's in, and so I can't really tell you anything. You know, you've asked me. I don't know why you're saying build a granny flat. If it's in New South Wales, well, you can build a granny flat anywhere. Whether you can rent it to another party is another question. So if you're not in New South Wales, if you're not in WA, if you're not in Northern Territory, if you're not in Toowoomba, Logan, Ipswich, Red, Moreton Bay, Redcliffe, Sunshine, what do we call them, on the Sunshine Coast, then you're not going to be able to legally rent it to two separate parties. You have to rent it to a family member. So, you know, a granny flat is only useful to you when you're renting in a renting when you are legally allowed to do that. From Ivan. Hi, Ian. I recall a comment you made in a previous webinar regarding benchtop stone versus laminate. Am I correct in recalling that stone are a better selling point for not great difference in cost? A simple yes-no answer. Yeah, look, nowadays, previously, there was a huge difference between laminate top and stone tops when it came to price. These days, it's just not that much different. With the amount of stuff that's coming in from China, much easier to put a stone bench top in and it will price better. So the difference is not much difference in price to install them, but a lot of difference in the selling price. So I'd go stone if you could. And look, if it's bloody, you know, if it's Frankston, you'd think about it. If it's Chipping Norton, oh, I can't even say that anymore. Chipping Norton's a good suburb now. Oh, God, I'm trying to think of a bad. If it's Coonamarra, Barra Brand in New South Wales, you know, you'd say, oh, what's the point? But If it's a decent suburb, I would be looking at it. From Richard, hi Ian. In your opinion, what is the best way to manage a small reno project in a vacant unit when I still need to work full time? Is it okay to give keys to the tradespeople, or should I hire someone to manage a project for me? Oh, look, Richard, those tradespeople, they're so untrustworthy, I'd never give my keys to them. I'm joking here. In the end, remember that with any renovation project or building project, you are going to get, you're going to have to ring 20 people and hopefully get 5 quotes, right? And in that whole process, you are going to meet the tradespeople and you are going to have confidence in some of them, in some of them, and in most of them, you're going to have no confidence at all. So in the end, look, you're giving a key to someone, and if they're going to steal something, they will. But I'm hoping that you've actually spoken to them enough, that you understand them enough, and that you've got them contracted, depending on what state you're in at what level. So remember, in some states, as soon as you do work over $1,000, you need a contract. In New South Wales, it just changed. And I'd have to go back to my notes. But I think in New South Wales, it's $5,000 now or $7,000, something like that. So as soon as you do a work over the value for the, of that sort of cost, that's when you need to start putting a contract in place. And most tradespeople have never seen a contract between a domestic owner and them. And so most of them will, that your market will be narrowed and you'll be picking someone that's half good because they understand what you're trying to do. And the second part of the question is, what's the most efficient way to organise quotes for a reno job? Many tradespeople need to see the project first, but I'm normally only available at night on weekend, which makes the process slow. Well, just set it up, mate. The first thing you've got to do is a scope of works. So the scope of works in your ultimate 3-day boot camp book, in the back of that is a scope of work that a student did. And just put it down in really simple, basic English what you want done. Then on the Saturday, make appointments every half hour with a number of different tradespeople, and they all know that you're getting prices, you know? And if some of them are going to be pissed off because the next person's coming in half an hour or they bump into each other, well, fuck, you know, that's their – sorry, I swore then. it's Australia Day. You know, they'll have to get over it because it's business. So remember, I'd like you to get 5 painter quotes, 5 plumbing quotes, 5 electrical quotes, 5 carpenter quotes, 5 kitchen quotes, 5 of everything, right? And just get it all out there. As soon as, like I said, as soon as you've spoken to that many people on, and look, some of them will come after work anyway. I know I used to quote stuff after hours. I used to quote stuff on Sunday. It just was. And some of them will do it. Some of them won't. Just make sure you do a scope of works that's very detailed so they can't hit you with any extras, okay? Because the worst thing you can do is go and do a renovation and then during the middle of it, add stuff to it or change your mind. If you change your mind, it's going to cost you double, I guarantee you. So I've seen people do renovations that blow out 50, 60, 70%. So just be very careful. Anyway, that's the last question. That's it for me. Thank you for listening. And remember to send your questions in to questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. That's questions@realestatesuccess.com.au, and they'll get given to me. Try and get them in by lunchtime of the Monday that we're doing the webinar, and we'll get that. So next webinar in a couple of weeks. So have a good day, and thank you to all of you that are telling me to have a good day as well. See you, Joseph.